The Dulles brothers, John Foster and Alan, were born into a patrician family with good connections both on Wall Street and in government, and both of them went on to serve in positions of political power during the Eisenhower administration. John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State, and Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, in a time of patriotic fervor, of McCarthyism fueled by fear of the Soviet Union. Their combined power in conceiving and executing covert American foreign policy has left us with a legacy of violence and anti-Americanism in countries ranging from Guatemala and Iran to the Congo. In his new book, The Brothers, Stephen Kinzer examines their impact on the modern histories of the United States and the world. It's published by Henry Holt, and I'm very pleased that it brings Stephen Kinzer back to our show. Hello.
Always good to be here.
How far back did the Dulles family go in this country?
Well, you added in this country. John Foster Dulles actually traced his ancestry back to Charlemagne. But in this country, they came over in the 18th century, and a very strong religious impulse through the family. They were clergymen and Presbyterian ministers and missionaries over generations. So that part of the background really did have an influence on the brothers.
The stories the missionaries told them shaped their worldview?
I think one of the reasons that the Dulles brothers are so interesting is that they combine, on the one hand, being so remarkable and extraordinary in their family background and their connections. On the other hand, in many ways, they reflect us. The forces that shaped the Dulles brothers also shaped America, shaped our approach to the world, and they still do. So this was definitely one of them, the belief in missionary Calvinism. So first of all, that teaches you that there's good and evil in the world. We're not all composed of good and evil. There are some that are good, and there are some that are evil. And if you believe that about religion, you can believe the same thing about politics. And the missionary instinct tells you it's not enough to just root for the triumph of good. You have to go out in the world and make sure that good crushes evil.
Now, their family went back in politics a while. Charlemagne, of course. But who was Grandfather Foster, John Watson Foster?
The two boys grew up in Watertown, New York, a little town on the shores of Lake Ontario, which was kind of a playground for the New York rich.
Their father was one of the coldest places I've ever been to.
Yeah, and I think some of the coldness may have penetrated into the Dulles brothers. When they were little boys, their father only allowed them to take cold showers because he thought that stiffened their character. So every morning during the summers, after singing their hymns and their prayers and having their cold shower, the boys would race down to the lakefront where their uncle, who was to be Secretary of State, and their grandfather, who had been Secretary of State, were waiting for them, and they would go off on these fishing trips. So John Watson Foster, their grandfather, had been Secretary of State in the 1890s. And in fact, I figured out he's the first American Secretary of State to preside over the overthrow of a foreign government. That was Hawaii in 1893. So maybe there's a genetic predisposition there. But Grandfather Foster, I think, was another important influence on the Dulles brothers and reflected another force in addition to missionary Calvinism that shaped them and that shape us. And it's the belief in American exceptionalism. So Grandfather Foster, as they called him, had lived the classic pioneer life in the age of manifest destiny. He had gone to the West and tamed the wilderness and fought the heathen savages and built a business and ingratiated himself to powerful men, got diplomatic posts, and then became Secretary of State. He truly assimilated the view that America had a God-given mission, and we were the peak of all of the millennia of civilizations, and it was now our job to spread what we knew onto other peoples. And of course, he thought of those other peoples as the ones that lived inside North America. But the Dulles brothers, when they came to power in the 1950s, took that idea of American exceptionalism and used it as a basis for spreading their views all over the world.
And it's still an issue in American politics today.
I would argue that both of these factors, the missionary instinct, the desire to convert people, and this sense that America has a special mission and is allowed to do things that other countries can't and shouldn't do, are two forces that not only shaped the Dulles brothers, but shaped our approach to the world and still do.
I was fascinated by the fact that Grandfather Foster, after he was Secretary of State, didn't return to his law practice in Indiana, but rather became what I would think of as a lobbyist today.
He might have been the first Washington lobbyist in this very specialized business of connecting international businesses to Washington. And that also became the third factor that I think shaped the Dulles brothers. So if the first was the missionary Calvinist instinct, and the second was the belief in American exceptionalism, the third was definitely their decades of service to corporate power. So the Dulles brothers were partners in this remarkable Wall Street law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. Foster Dulles became the richest, highest-paid lawyer in America. And this law firm had a special specialty. It wasn't like a normal law firm. Its specialty was pushing around small countries to make them do what big American corporations wanted them to do. They were so successful at this that essentially every major American multinational corporation hired Sullivan and Cromwell, and this gave the Dulles brothers great experience in imposing their views on weak countries.
And they would work for the government at the same time that they were working for the law firm.
It's remarkable that this revolving door and conflict of interest would have been not only unethical now, but completely illegal. However, in those days, it was no big deal. They would, for example, represent steel makers as lawyers. Then they would go off to a disarmament conference, which, if successful, would be devastating for the steel industry. They would then make sure there were no disarmament agreements.
And also, the Panama Canal was part of the Sullivan and Cromwell purview.
It's hard to imagine any major American intervention, and certainly in the first half of the 20th century in this hemisphere, in which Sullivan and Cromwell and its clients were not involved.
My guest is Stephen Kinzer. His book, The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War, is published by Times Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You called John Foster Dulles Foster throughout the book, and Alan Alley. I guess those were the names that they were known by in the family.
Alley changed his name to Alan when he got a little bit older. Foster was always known by that name. And one of the interesting things I found when writing this book and essentially living with the Dulles brothers for a few years is that although they saw the world in exactly the same way, and politically and ideologically, they were twins, in their private lives, in their personalities, they were polar opposites. So John Foster Dulles was sour, egotistical, arrogant, socially awkward. He was a very unpleasant dinner guest with a whole series of bad habits that I categorize in my book. Alan Dulles was just the opposite. He was a sparkling figure, a great conversationalist, had 1,000 stories. He loved good wine. He had 100 mistresses from Claire Booth Luce to the Queen of Greece. And I think this was important because Alan Dulles, as head of the CIA, was not only the head of the invisible government, he was also the ambassador of the invisible government to the visible government. And I think after those glittering Georgetown cocktail parties that he attended, many people would go home thinking, we don't really know what the CIA is, we don't know what it does, but if it's run by such a wonderful guy as Alan Dulles, we should allow it to do whatever it wants.
On the other hand, he was involved with a number of women who today would have caused scandals for the head of the CIA.
It's remarkable when we think that just a couple of years ago, a director of the CIA had to resign over an affair with one woman. Alan Dulles was an absolutely unrepentant adulterer. And actually, as I went through this book, the process of writing it, it occurred to me that this would have, we would say today, opened him up to blackmail. So why didn't, for example, the Soviets come to him and confront him and blackmail him? So one of my fantasies is that actually they did. And they told him, we're going to make all this public unless you carry out interventions around the world which will destroy America's security and image for 100 years. And he agreed to do it.
The John Foster Dulles went to Princeton, didn't he? Wilson at Princeton at the time?
Yes. And in fact, Wilson was a huge influence on the Dulles brothers.
But the Dulles brothers were Republicans. Woodrow Wilson was a Democrat.
That's true. However, they both were paragons of this ideology called corporate globalism or liberal internationalism. Not only did the Dulles brothers study under Wilson, but they were with him at the Paris Peace Conference after World War I. And I think they—
While they were students?
No, they were not students anymore. They were already young lawyers, and they gained Wilson's confidence, and I think they absorbed from him this view that the United States has vital interests everywhere in the world, and everywhere is where we need to be involved.
Foster said he was going to be a Christian lawyer. What did he mean by that?
I think he always felt a deep Christian religiosity, which leads to an interesting question. Since he believed in what he kept calling Christian principles and democracy and freedom, how did he justify going into a country like Iran or Guatemala that had a relatively well-functioning democracy and then leave it with a tyranny? How was he able to tell himself that he had made that country more free or more democratic? And I think it was this. He devised a definition of freedom in which civil rights and personal freedoms did not enter. And the real defining quality was whether a country was open and free for American business. If it was open for business, if there were free trade, if companies could freely come and go, it was a free country. And by that standard, you can argue that Iran, say, under the Shah, was a more free country than it was under Mohammad Mossadegh, the elected leader.
We could also say that Saudi Arabia is a freer country than an awful lot of other countries that have more troubled relations with the United States.
And that's exactly part of the Dulles legacy. You know, one of the points of my book is that we misunderstood the history of the 1950s. We think of it as a period of peace, tense peace. But actually, the Dulles brothers led the United States into a series of wars that essentially constituted one long battle during all of the 1950s.
You mentioned their grandfather, who was Secretary of State, but their uncle, Robert Lansing, Uncle Bert, also was Secretary of State. When was he made Secretary of State?
Lansing was Secretary of State under Woodrow Wilson, and he also played a role in bringing up the career of the brothers. Not only did he subsidize them, but I give you one example. At one point in 1917, the Liberal Party in Cuba, which wanted to limit foreign intervention, won an election. The conservatives refused to accept the results of the election, and they had the support of big American corporations that were terrified of this new political party. All these corporations had Sullivan and Cromwell as their lawyers. So they came to Sullivan and Cromwell and said, "You've got to solve our problem in Cuba because our plantations and our other investments are under threat." So Foster Dulles got on the train from New York. He went to Washington to meet Uncle Bert, who happened to be Secretary of State Lansing. He told him the problem. Uncle Bert asked him what he should do. And Foster said, "We should send two warships full of Marines to land in Cuba and put down that liberal rebellion." The next day, those two ships landed, 6,000 Marines debarked. They began a five-year occupation of Cuba. They protected Sullivan and Cromwell clients, but they sowed the seeds for a lot of trouble that was to explode in a few decades.
Now, during World War I, the United States did not engage in the kind of spying that other countries did. But Alan Dulles winds up going into intelligence. What's the story there?
It's a very interesting background. So young Alley, when he was still 10 and 12 years old, was invited with his brother to all these glittering dinners at Grandfather Foster's house. And afterwards, Alan Dulles, as a little kid, would go up to his room and write what amounted to intelligence reports to himself about who'd been there and what they had said. So he showed a bent in that direction from an early age. In Switzerland, he was a young diplomat assigned during World War I to intelligence matters, and he got his first taste of the business. One of the stories that he loved to tell to CIA officers entering the agency decades later was one that came from this period during World War I. Alan, as we mentioned earlier, was a great womanizer and had a hot date on this weekend in question. And as he was leaving the office, the phone rang, and it was one of these many European exiles living in Switzerland who demanded to see him immediately with a very heavy accent. He said, "I have a message for the United States. I must speak to the United States." And Alan kept telling him, "You can come on Monday. Forget it. I'm busy now, and I'm busy over the weekend." They went back and forth. Finally, Alan hung up the phone. He went off on his date. He forgot about the incident until years later he figured out who was the guy that was calling me and telling me he had a message for the United States. It was Lenin. And it was that next day that Lenin got on his sealed train and made his way off to change history in St. Petersburg.
Well, that's, I guess, a lesson for somebody in intelligence that you put off the date.
I think Allen was trying to tell his officers, think with your head.
My guest is Stephen Kinzer, whose latest book is The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Allen Dulles, and Their Secret World War. It is published by Times Books. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Stephen Kinzer, whose latest book is The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Allen Dulles, and Their Secret World War. It is published by Times Books. So you mentioned that the brothers went to the Paris peace talks after World War I, representing the United States for Woodrow Wilson.
They served on different committees. So Foster Dulles became the head of the American representative and essentially a key figure on the reparations committee, working under Bernard Baruch. That reparations committee developed highly complicated formulae by which Germany would have to repay its debts and its war obligations. And Foster Dulles emerged as one of the very few people who understood these very arcane details. That information was extremely valuable to him as a lawyer. He went on to become, in the 1930s, from the time Hitler took power to the late 30s, the number one salesman in the world for bonds for German corporations and German municipalities. So he had his roots in the Paris peace talks that proved very profitable. Allen Dulles was on the border. Well, I called it the Boundary Commission. And he later said he was partly responsible for creating Czechoslovakia, which he said looks like a big banana on the face of Europe.
Now, why wasn't Foster hurt by the fact that he had been so friendly to Hitler?
It's a curious situation. Foster Dulles had a great admiration for Germany. He once described Hitler as a man who, despite the handicap of foreign birth, has risen to the unquestioned leadership of a great nation. He was always jealous of Allen because his younger brother Allen had met Hitler. He never had.
He saw Hitler as a bulwark against Stalin?
Absolutely. During the period of the 1930s, he was very sympathetic to Hitler as an anti-Bolshevik leader. And then there was a fascinating episode at Sullivan and Cromwell as it became more and more difficult to practice law in Germany, particularly if you had Jewish clients. There was a seminal meeting of the partners here in New York about whether they should close the Sullivan and Cromwell office in Germany. Foster was completely against this, but he lost. All the other lawyers who were partners decided it's gone too far. We have to close our office in Germany. And that was in 1935. But if you look at the official records, it's dated 1934, because Foster Dulles backdated it to make it look like he had pulled the firm out earlier than he actually had.
He was he ran Sullivan and Cromwell at the same time that he was engaged in government activities?
Absolutely. He was the managing partner of Sullivan and Cromwell, and I think that he would have absorbed from this job the idea that serving the big American corporations abroad and serving the national interest of the United States was the same thing. So he wouldn't have seen any kind of a conflict going back and forth. And when he came into power in the 1950s, he viewed his job principally as protecting the right of American corporate power to extend its influence around the world.
What had they done during World War II?
So Foster Dulles remained at the law firm and was active in a number of wartime commissions in Washington. He couldn't get into the Army because he had bad eyesight, which was a chronic debility in the Dulles family. Allen, however, joined the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services.
Which later became the CIA.
It was the predecessor of the CIA. And Allen actually spent those years back in Switzerland, just where he had been during World War I, doing a similar job.
And he had a mistress during the war who also worked as a spy. She introduced him to the psychologist Carl Gustav Jung.
When I read about the connection between Allen Dulles and Jung, I grabbed onto it and I realized I had to investigate this and put it in my book. It really is fascinating. So it's true. Allen's principal mistress during the Second World War was a woman who had been treated by Jung. Allen then went to meet him. Jung wrote a series of psychological profiles of Nazi leaders for Allen, which Allen then forwarded to Eisenhower, who later wrote Jung a letter congratulating him or thanking him for his work. Several of the Dulles relatives became Jungians. One became actually a Jungian analyst, now living in Santa Fe. So what Alan had in mind was what he called a union between espionage and psychology.
Well, was any of this useful?
I doubt it, actually. I think Alan Dulles had a very closed mind. In many ways, this is one thing I hold against the Dulles brothers. They were very intellectually uncreative. What they believed when they were 12 years old was what they believed their whole life. So meeting a fascinating visionary like Jung probably did not have as much of an influence on him as it might have had on some others.
Did Foster remain very religious?
Yes, if you use his definition of religious. He always attended church. He was steeped in the Presbyterian magisterium. He was a trustee of the Union Theological Seminary. He participated in a number of religious gatherings. But as the 1950s unfolded, he found himself more and more isolated as a number of Christian groups in the U.S. and the world began to call for things that he hated, like getting along with countries in the third world that were neutralist or even recognizing communist China. So he felt that the religious foundation was falling away from under him.
Now, Truman was the president after the war. Did the Dulleses remain in government?
Foster Dulles was back in the law firm and actually applied for a job in the Truman administration. Truman wouldn't give it to him.
He didn't like the Dulles brothers.
He did not. He called Foster Dulles that fella from Wall Street. However, Truman did use Foster Dulles to negotiate the final peace treaty with Japan. He was very successful in doing that. And Alan Dulles, under the Truman administration, came into the CIA in a secondary position. And this was the beginning of his desire to overthrow two countries, Iran and Guatemala. He proposed both of those operations under Truman, and Truman rejected them both. And the reason why Alan Dulles and Foster Dulles later were so eager to overthrow Mossadegh in Iran and Arbenz in Guatemala was that both of them had dealt devastating blows against Sullivan and Cromwell clients. So Mossadegh had nationalized the oil industry in Iran, which was owned by one British company. Its bank was the Schroeder Bank, big client of Sullivan and Cromwell. And in fact, Alan Dulles was on the board of the Schroeder Bank. Later on in Guatemala, there was a Land Reform Act that affected the United Fruit Company, whose banker was also Schroeder Bank. So the Dulles brothers had to go back to their clients and say, we failed you because we couldn't protect you against Mossadegh and Arbenz. The moment they got into office, they started plotting against those two guys, and they didn't stop until they'd overthrown both of them.
Now, Kim Philby was the senior British intelligence officer assigned as liaison to the CIA. Of course, he turned out to be a double agent, and he knew Alan?
Yes, Kim Philby and Alan did work together. I think it is also an important part of the story because part of Alan Dulles' idea during the 1950s was to send agents and operatives and guerrilla fighters behind the Iron Curtain. He was landing them in Albania, in Latvia, in the Ukraine, and he would use them to – the idea was to foment revolution and uprising and spread sabotage, but they were all picked up and killed, hundreds in Europe and thousands in Asia. Later it became clear that the reason for this was that the senior British intelligence officer assigned as a liaison to the CIA was actually working for the Soviets.
Now, Eisenhower ended the war in Korea. He came in as a kind of a peace president, the general who could. And as I understand it, he didn't approve of campaigns aimed at overthrowing established communist regimes. So what happened? How did we wind up overthrowing these other countries?
Eisenhower's role is particularly interesting. He was a fervent supporter of covert action and clandestine operations. And I think part of the reason might be what you just mentioned. Foster Dulles had this great idea of rollback and liberation. That we were not just going to contain communism. We were going to go get it where it lived and overthrow it. Eisenhower was very reluctant about that. And when Foster wrote speeches for him demanding the liberation of enslaved nations, Eisenhower used to add in, by peaceful means. However, in power, Eisenhower became a fervent supporter of covert operations. We don't know why, because in those days you never even admitted that there were covert operations.
Until the U-2 was
that was
down.
One that he had to admit. But I think we can think of at least two reasons why Eisenhower would have so strongly supported covert operations. One is, we didn't know it at the time, but covert operations and secret plots were very important in World War II, including the breaking of the Nazi codes. So Eisenhower would have developed an appreciation for that kind of work. And secondly, I think Eisenhower would have seen clandestine overthrows of governments as a kind of a peace project. Here was a guy that had to send people out to die by the thousands. This must have weighed on him. And here somebody presents him with a way to overthrow a government and only a couple of dozen people die and none of them are American.
The Dulles brothers are both working in government. Are they working in tandem?
Very closely. So every day, unless one of them was out of town, Foster Dulles would go to the White House to see Eisenhower for drinks around 6 o'clock. And every day, Foster Dulles and Allen Dulles would also speak and meet. And nobody else was present at these meetings. No notes were taken. But this is the way the real foreign policy was made. It went straight from Eisenhower to the Secretary of State, Foster Dulles, to the CIA Director, Allen Dulles.
Now, John Foster Dulles is most famous for his talk about brinksmanship as an approach to diplomacy. Did he really believe in that, or was that a cover for all sorts of other things like the covert operations?
John Foster Dulles believed very fervently that the United States should never sit down to talk or negotiate with its enemies or its rivals. He believed that that would just collapse the entire paradigm of hostility between the superpowers. And I think this points to another one of his failures of imagination that he shares with Eisenhower, and that is, none of them had any concept of what we now call blowback. It never occurred to them that these covert operations would have terrible effects decades later. That's at least one part of their legacy that we can apply today.
How did they deal with McCarthy?
They dealt with Joe McCarthy in very different ways. Foster Dulles succumbed entirely to McCarthy. I think he had decided after Wilson that the lesson was secretaries of state should always accommodate powerful senators. So he allowed Joe McCarthy to send one of his principal aides, a former FBI agent, to the State Department. He launched a purge in which hundreds of diplomats were fired, the China hands just being the most famous case. And he collaborated quite closely with McCarthy. But Allen Dulles was different. Allen Dulles received a summons for one of his officers to come and testify in front of the McCarthy Committee, and he refused to send the guy. And he went to Capitol Hill and told McCarthy he was not going to be able to penetrate into the CIA, and actually he never did.
Did the press ever challenge the brothers?
The press was a willing cooperator with what they were doing. Bear in mind that during the 1950s, we were living through what I would call maybe the last great consensus in America on foreign policy. It was shared by both parties. It was shared by most institutions, and it was shared by the press. So Foster Dulles would make speeches, for example, denouncing the leaders of Country X for being too leftist or too pro-communist. Then Allen would secretly foment upheaval in those countries. And then Foster would make more speeches saying how wonderful it was that the people of Country X have risen up against their evil leaders.
Foster Dulles arranged for the nuclear bomb tests in the Nevada desert to be broadcast on television. I guess a way of saying, look how powerful we are.
I think he also wanted to show Americans we are under siege at every moment and we have danger everywhere.
We have very little time, but we didn't get to Vietnam and we haven't gotten to the ends of their lives. But what role did they play in us getting into Vietnam? Eisenhower did not want to send troops there.
He didn't, but John Foster Dulles was the number one figure who got America involved in Vietnam. And I think in the end, one of the interesting things we can conclude is that these brothers were enormously influential. There probably wasn't a literate human being on Earth who didn't know their names in the 1950s, but now they've been all but forgotten. In my book, in a way, is an effort to try to fight this historical amnesia by bringing these remarkable brothers back to life.
Because they both died with their reputations intact, in effect.
But they didn't get a chance to read my book.
Stephen Kinzer's book is The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and Their Secret World War. It is published by Times Books. And I thank you so much for being on our show.
It's always a special privilege to be here.